to band together to import additional tasty treats for themselves. But money was in short supply, with Spanish dollars, Irish banknotes and assorted copper coins dribbling into the colony and draining out of it even quicker. However, officers of the corps were issued with bills of exchange to cover their pay, and those bills could be redeemed for sterling in Britain. The officers bought the cargoes of ships docking in Sydney and onsold them with markups that would make a used car dealer blush. Sydney was only just emerging from starvation, and the officers were pleased to discover that the colonists would hand over everything they owned for a bag of rice. Colonists who attempted to deal directly with traders were the victims of unfortunate accidents, like falling down their bedroom stairs in the middle of the night. Accidents of this kind were regarded as particularly unfortunate because everyone lived in single-storey houses. Traders who tried to bypass the corps were stopped from unloading their ships and had future cargoes boycotted. The corps was determined that the colony's magistrates should not stop its game of monopoly, so Gross fired them all and stacked the bench with hand-picked military officers. The officers used the stack bench to their advantage, bringing fraudulent prosecutions against those who interfered with their business dealings. The officers accepted payments from convicts to amend their criminal records and provided a boutique revenge service, enabling jilted lovers and other malcontents to buy longer sentences for their enemies. MacArthur was the calm eye of the corps' storm, untouchable at its centre. He was an early investor in the corps' racketeering, but made his real money by privatising New South Wales. More than any other man, he was responsible for dismantling Phillip's socialist bureaucracy and loosing the running dogs of capital upon the colony. Gross was interested in comfort, not power. Time spent pulling the levers of government was time spent away from the French cheese and racy little Spanish sherry that MacArthur had just imported for him. Declaring, "I am unequal to manage by myself," he appointed MacArthur as Inspector of Public Works for the thriving new settlement of Parramatta. MacArthur believed that public works didn't. Phillip's government farms only produced food, but in private hands they could grow rich crops of money. The British government had recently agreed that officers could be granted land without resigning their commissions, an unusual arrangement considered necessary to attract soldiers to serve at the arse end of the world. MacArthur, who was responsible for allocating land on the fertile Cumberland Plain, granted the most barren and rocky parcels to freed convicts and the few recently arrived free settlers, reserving the most attractive holdings for his cronies. He took 100 acres of the best land at Parramatta, named it Elizabeth Farm after his wife, and rapidly expanded his property portfolio by recommending further grants to himself. Elizabeth Farm is Australia's oldest surviving homestead. Here Elizabeth lived in isolation, complaining of having no female friend to unbend my mind to. The only woman from her social stratum was Mrs. Reverend Johnson, a tedious godbotherer from whom she derived neither pleasure nor profit. Elizabeth, who had lived a life of comfort as the daughter of a respectable landowner, found herself stranded on the other side of the globe with a bunch of prostitutes who couldn't play the piano, stitch needlepoint portraits of charming woodland animals, or engage in polite drawing-room conversation about nothing. While Gross advised Britain that the new soldier farmers were clearing their fields at their own expense, he had in fact granted each of them 10 convict labourers, all fed and clothed by the British taxpayer. Subsequent orders from London that officers be granted no more than 2 convicts each were studiously ignored. MacArthur was responsible for allocating convict workers in his fiefdom. He and his allies creamed the top off the labour market, while those who displeased him received farmhands riddled with tuberculosis, equipped with fewer than the usual number of limbs, or unnaturally interested in the colony's limited supply of livestock. A steady trickle of animal husbandry cases came before the courts in the early days of settlement. Successful prosecutions were difficult because of the requirement that 2 witnesses give evidence against the accused. Offenders not only had to be deviants, but exhibitionists to boot. James Rees was executed in 1799 for making bacon, as was the unfortunate sow he'd befriended. The colonial courts would also order the death of any 4-legged party to such proceedings in accordance with Leviticus 20:15. And if a man lie with a beast, he shall surely be put to death, and ye shall slay the beast. MacArthur, meanwhile, deliberately ran down the public farms. Public convicts received smaller rations and were forced to labour for private landowners in their spare time to survive. When the public housing for convicts blew down in a storm, it was not rebuilt. Most audaciously, MacArthur ordered that the government store was not to accept free grain from the public farms until it had purchased all of the officers' crops. The officers had been granted free land, their labour costs were met by the British taxpayer, and then, in a breathtaking display of double-dipping, the taxpayer was slugged again to purchase their produce. Australian farmers have sought to socialise costs and privatise benefits ever since. Fucking Egypts. Although they had their pick of the convicts, MacArthur and his henchmen couldn't find enough experienced farmhands to tend their ever-expanding estates. Most of the English convicts were city dwellers, whose only experience with a hoe was with a lady who pretended to be really good at sewing. What the farmers really needed were some poor, oppressed country folk. Cue the Irish. The Irish had been practising being oppressed by English landowners for centuries. Most of them were Papists, which was English bigot speak for Catholics. The English had themselves been Catholics until 1534, but decided that the Roman Church had lost its moral legitimacy when it refused King Henry VIII permission to trade in his ugly old Spanish wife for his smoking hot mistress. The English took their anti-Catholicism seriously. Catholics kept sneaking back onto the throne, so they passed laws that the monarch could not profess the popish religion or marry a papist. This did not stop King George IV, a trenchant critic of Catholic emancipation, from secretly marrying his long-term Catholic mistress, Maria Fitzherbert. The provisions of the 1701 Act of Settlement that prevent the British monarch from marrying a Catholic were still in effect in 2013. Back in Ireland, Catholics were barred from holding public office and fined for not attending Anglican services. Irish Catholics could not own firearms or horses worth more than £5 and were forbidden from taking custody of orphans to protect vulnerable youth from the taint of papism. When a Protestant landowner died, his land passed to his eldest son. When a Catholic died, the Popery Act required his land to be split among his sons, breaking up the great Catholic estates. The law also required that Catholic churches be made from wood, so that they could be burned down more easily when the local Catholics misbehaved. Ireland in the late 18th century was still a feudal society. Most of the large landowners were Protestant and most of the serfs were Catholic. The English loved to make jokes about the Irish peasantry being a bit dim, and there was some truth in this stereotype. Catholic priests had been banned from educating little tykes, and malnutrition resulted in high levels of mental retardation. By 1780, 90% of the Irish were dependent on potatoes for sustenance. The 1815 Statistical Survey of Ireland found that Kilkenny labourers live entirely on potatoes and sour milk. The poor of County Clare didn't even get sour milk for 3 months of the year, making do with potatoes and salt. This diet meant that the Irish poor suffered from scurvy and scrofulous disorders, spoke slowly, and had difficulty tying their own shoelaces. The Irish were not initially transported to New South Wales. Instead, they were sent to Canada, which was the bit of America the Americans didn't want. Irish convicts had an even worse time of it than their English counterparts. In 1788, the Providence carried 126 of them to Canada. The 80 who survived the four-week voyage were thrown into the rocky surf at gunpoint. One perished when dashed against the rocks, six died of exposure, and the rest were taken to the Nova Scotian village of Sydney. The British loved naming their miserable, lice-infested convict settlements after Lord Sydney. Lord Sydney would have preferred sponsoring a town with a cathedral, or at least a nice fountain. Sir Henry Brown Hayes, the Sheriff of Cork, sent the first Irish convicts to Sydney, not the Canadian one, aboard the Queen in 1791. Most of these convicts had committed the standard crimes, stealing handkerchiefs, wandering about with blackened faces, interfering with fish ponds. But some had committed offences that were uniquely Irish. For example, the innumerate or unipedal Mary McLaughlin was transported for felony of sock. Some Irish convicts were never tried or sentenced, but transported simply for the crime of Irishness. Irish women, unlike their English sisters, could be transported for the crime of homelessness. Irish gentlemen of limited means, meanwhile, all too frequently carried away maidens that be inheritors. Abducting heiresses was a peculiarly Irish offence that involved bursting into a ballroom wearing a mask, throwing the nearest heiress onto a horse valued at less than £5, galloping off to meet an unscrupulous priest who would perform a marriage for half a pint of Guinness, deflowering said heiress in a barn, taking her back to her home, and demanding that her guardian hand over her inheritance. The guardian would generally comply, as the Catholic Church judged divorce to be a far greater sin than raping a young woman in a barn. Abducting heiresses was so popular that groups of like-minded Irish youths formed abduction clubs. Club members paid household servants to report on the fortunes and movements of potential wives and drew lots to determine which lucky bachelor would get the girl. The club would then help the winner to kidnap his prize. Sir Henry Brown Hayes, having dispatched the first Irish convicts to Australia, joined them after abducting Mary Pike, who had been left £20,000 by her doting grandfather. He had made the mistake of abducting a Quaker. Quakers took a far more pragmatic approach to divorce than Catholics and generally frowned upon the whole barn business. Hayes was transported for life, but his status allowed him to purchase a comfortable cabin aboard the Atlas, while 64 of his countrymen died below. Peers of the realm were not expected to do convicty things, so Hayes was permitted to build himself the luxurious Vaucluse House, which he surrounded with 500 tons of imported Irish turf in the belief that grass from the land trodden by St. Patrick would ward off the colony's snakes. Hayes was also noted for playing host to the colony's largest moustache in an era when facial hair was unfashionable, having sworn an oath not to cut the hair on his upper lip until he was free to return to Ireland. Moustache growing was a uniquely Irish form of political protest. The English colonists were greatly amused by the superstitious Paddies who now walked among them, wearing funny hats, smoking little clay pipes, and saying incomprehensible things like, "Begorrow." The Book of Leinster, a 12th century manuscript of Gaelic literature and mythology, perfectly sums up the superstitious nature and general credulity of the Irish. The scribe who copied it warned his Irish readers, "Do not credit the details of the story or fantasy. Some things in it are devilish lies, and some poetical figments. Some seem possible, and others not. Some are for the enjoyment of idiots." The Irish convicts who disembarked in New South Wales from the Queen in 1792 reinforced the view that the Irish had spent too long paddling in the shallow end of the gene pool. The Irish were enthusiastic, if not terribly successful, escape artists. In 1792, 21 of the Queen convicts escaped Sydney, equipped with a paper compass one of them had drawn, and started walking to China, which they believed lay about 150 miles to the north. Whenever the escapees ran into an obstacle, the one holding the paper would simply rotate it so that the arrow pointed away from the cliff face, ocean, or band of angry Aborigines that blocked his path. Then he and his fellow escapees would dutifully follow the arrow until something else got in their way. Watkin Tench described how these Chinese travellers were later discovered naked, starving, and eating poisonous berries. One had died of fatigue, another of spear, and four had been seriously roughed up by the Eora. They had managed to escape an impressive 26 miles. In 1798, David Collins recounted the tale of another group of Irish prisoners who'd decided to run away to a secret white empire that they believed lay about 300 miles southwest of Sydney, in which they were assured of finding all the comforts of life without the necessity of labouring for them. The governor got wind of their plan, and given the various ingenious ways in which previous Irish escapees had managed to die, was concerned for their welfare. And so began the only state-sponsored prison breakout in Australian history. The governor provided the escapees with provisions and an armed escort and told them to be careful. He also appointed John Wilson to guide them to the purported location of the lost civilization so that they could see that there was nothing there. Wilson was a First Fleet cloth thief who later renounced all cloth goods, preferring instead to wander about in a kangaroo skin loincloth. He moved in with an Aboriginal tribe, was marked with the ritual scars of initiation, attempted to abduct young Aboriginal and European girls, and took up the name Bunbowee. Bunbowee had explored all the countryside within 100 miles of the colony and crossed the Blue Mountains more than 15 years before Blaxland, Wentworth and Lawson. Blaxland, Wentworth and Lawson continue to be credited as the first Europeans to cross the Blue Mountains because they fit the noble explorer stereotype. They were wealthy, had nice haircuts and wore cravats. Australians do not like to think that their continent was unlocked by a wild-eyed, dreadlocked, marsupial-clad pedophile. The escapees accompanying Wilson soon got tired and asked to go home. The expedition's lasting legacy was the discovery of the koala, an animal whose mindless imbecility rivaled that of the Irish. The koala was originally known as the Kullawine. It was then called sloth, monkey and monkey bear before its current name stuck. None of this worried the koala, which was too whacked on gum leaves to care what people called it. David Collins, who was contemptuous of the Irish in the way that only an Anglo-Irishman could be, wrote in recounting the heroic failures of numerous Irish escapees, "Could it be imagined that at this day there was existing in a polished civilised kingdom a race of beings, for they do not deserve the appellation of men, so extremely ignorant and so little humanised as these were, compared with whom the naked savages of the mountain were an enlightened people?" Although the English colonists liked to look down on their cousins from across the Western Sea, the Irish were initially welcomed to New South Wales. They liked to drink in a fight and were kind of fun. They also knew how to work on a farm without getting paid. The Irish were vital to the New South Wales economy, particularly as the transportation of English convicts was declining. Back in Europe, a young officer named Napoleon had radically departed from French military tradition. He ignored the time-honoured tactics of le surrender and le runaway and was actually winning battles. England was once again at war with France and needed all of its undesirables to stand in front of Napoleon's cannons. The Irish were not trusted for this important job because they kept asking the French to help them drive the British out of Ireland. So Irish transportation increased as English transportation slowed. More than 165,000 convicts arrived in Australia between 1788 and 1868. About a quarter of them, and half of all convict women, were Irish. Australia's Irish population exploded with the introduction of assisted immigration and the influx of tens of thousands of people who liked to get drunk at parties but who were ideologically opposed to contraception. The rate of Irish immigration and childbirth in Australia's early days means there's a little bit of Egypt in most of us. The liquid economy. Adam Smith's 1776 blockbuster, The Wealth of Nations, urged against government interference in the economy. Smith argued that the most successful societies allow self-interest to flourish, with the riches accrued by the enterprising and ambitious trickling down into the pockets of the grateful everyman. He also wrote, "The colony of a civilised nation which takes possession either of a waste country or of one so thinly inhabited that the natives easily give place to the new settlers, advances more rapidly to wealth and greatness than any other human society." Smith was strangely silent on what the natives get out of such an arrangement. Presumably, they get a warm inner glow from knowing that they have done their bit to make the enterprising and ambitious foreigners who have built a wheat farm on their traditional hunting grounds more successful. Smith's "greed is good" mantra was music to MacArthur's ears. Smith had not only earmarked him for wealth and greatness, but had made it clear that his being an exploitative bastard was, in fact, a public service. Liquid assets are more capable of trickling down than illiquid ones, so rum became the currency of choice, with the pound making way for the pint and the shilling swapped for the shot. While Navy sailors and Essex Bond had sly grog spirits into the colony from its earliest days, the rum ball really started rolling in 1793, when Gross purchased the cargo of the Hope, an American sealer that reportedly would not sell its food supplies unless Gross also bought its spirits. Gross made all the right kind of protesting noises for the benefit of his political masters in London, who still envisaged New South Wales as a dry colony. He then sold the barrels of rum to the colony's officers, who traded it by the bottle to thirsty convicts and free settlers with markups of up to 1,200%. By the end of the year, the Corps was importing stills to brew money and ruthlessly cracking down on any settler found forging moonshine. The soldiers who ruled New South Wales had earned their infamous Rum Corps moniker. The colony's lack of money meant that barter was the norm, with farmers paying their workers in sugar, tobacco, and to the joy of their convict labourers, handkerchiefs. But not even the handkerchief could compete with rum. David Collins, who despite his taste for a bit of convict strange, was cementing himself as the colony's moralist, glumly reported that the convicts preferred receiving liquor for labour to every other article of provisions or clothing that could be offered them. The convicts gratefully received their wages by the bottle or jug and would bundy on as soon as they'd bundied off. Collins was convinced that liquor led to other vices, particularly gambling. He wrote, "To such excess was this pursuit carried among the convicts that some had been known, after losing provisions, money and all their spare clothing, to have staked and lost the very clothes on their wretched backs, standing in the midst of their associates as naked and as indifferent about it as the unconscious natives of the country." Alexandro Malaspina, a Spaniard who visited Sydney in 1793, was amazed by all the new drunks who wanted to play cards with him. He wrote of the colonists' continued abuse of liquor and frequent at times baseless duels, but believed the colony's moral laxity was most apparent in its women, who approach announcing the price at which they sell their favours. The excess of alcohol had a profound impact on New South Wales. One Christmas Eve, two settlers competed in a drinking competition using raw spirits, and one did not wake up to find out whether Santa thought he'd been naughty or nice. Thomas Daveney, a convict judged by Philip to be a most useful man and promoted to overseer of the Toongabby public farm, met his end in half a gallon of Cape brandy. Rumours circulated that the officers were buying the land of desperate drunks for a bottle of rum a plot. Yet Smith's trickle-down theory proved accurate in New South Wales. The colony was becoming prosperous in appearance, with stately homes springing up between groves of Banksia and Grevillea. As agriculture expanded, the threat of famine receded. Women who had been unable to fall pregnant after years of grinding poverty suddenly became fertile, and Australia underwent its first baby boom. In 1801, the visiting French naturalist François Piron noted that, "After residing a year or two at Port Jackson, most of the English prostitutes became remarkably fruitful." Rather than attributing this to changes in climate and diet, he believed the fertility of the disgusting prostitutes was linked to the sudden revolution in their moral conduct, paradoxically arguing that a reduction in sexual activity resulted in more babies as an excess of sexual intercourse destroys the sensibility of the female organs. Things were also looking up for the convicts. They became part of the private economy, receiving payment for work performed outside regular convicting hours. The officers' social snobbery and general laziness prevented them from retailing, so they wholesaled to their convict mistresses or servants, who opened shops and taverns. Convict agents like Simeon Lord soon owned grander houses than the governor. In 1794, James Roos left the land granted to him by Philip and led 22 mostly ex-convict farmers to settle the Hawkesbury. Collins wrote disapprovingly that the Hawkesbury settlers consumed their time and substance in drinking and rioting, entrusting to the extreme fertility of the soil, which they declared would produce an ample crop at any time without much labour. The authorities back in Britain began to get edgy about all the healthy convicts drinking rum in the sun, while the homegrown poor continued to scrabble for scraps in the smog and muck. The English clergyman Sidney Smith wrote, "The ancient avocation of picking pockets will certainly not become more discredited from the knowledge that it may eventually lead to the possession of a farm of 1,000 acres on the River Hawkesbury." Smith was a towering intellect and moral philosopher and the greatest satirist since Jonathan Swift. Yet today he is best known for his rhyming recipe for potato salad, popularised in Common Sense in the Household, a manual of practical housewifery. Although the colony had developed rapidly following Philip's departure, the coarse days of rum and roses were drawing to a close. Mother Britain had wearied of military rule in her father's flung outpost and was preparing to send a plague of governors to blight the House of MacArthur. Chapter 7. A Dish Best Served Cold. Before you embark on a journey of revenge, dig two graves. Confucius, circa 500 BC. Hunter becomes the hunted. Major Grocer's departure for Britain in 1794 heralded 14 years of strife and bloody vengeance within the colony. MacArthur fought successive governors, Bligh fought successive crews, the Aborigines fought the colonists, and the Irish fought each other and everyone else. Governor John Hunter arrived in 1795 with orders to wrest power back from the junta. Hunter, at 58 years of age, was well past his use-by date. Now, before older listeners start writing outrage letters to their local newspaper or anyone else who still listens to them, they should note that the average British life expectancy in 1795 was 40 years. Governor Hunter had no experience running anything more complicated than a ship, three of which he'd sunk. Philip had sent him back to London to be court-martialed for trashing the Sirius, and the new Home Secretary, the Duke of Portland, thought it would be best to offer him a job on land where he could do less damage. Hunter had an excellent sense of humour and loved music, painting and long walks in the woods, during which he indulged his passion for natural history. With this sort of profile, one would have expected him to have been overwhelmed with RSVP hits, but Hunter was a committed bachelor and misogynist. Portland had instructed Hunter to crack down on the liquor trade and ensure that landowners were assigned no more than two convicts apiece, whom they would feed and clothe at their own expense. Hunter failed to carry out these instructions as he had fallen under the spell of the charismatic MacArthur, who'd shown him a teetotaler convict taking all day to dig up a potato on a rundown public farm. MacArthur convinced the new governor that the colony would starve without happy drunks labouring for poor philanthropist farmers who could barely feed and clothe themselves, let alone provide snacks and trousers to the useless criminals they so generously employed. Hunter was initially blind to the depredations of the corps. Instead, he blamed all of New South Wales's ills on its women, whom he insisted were refractory and disobedient, and at the bottom of every infamous transaction in the colony. Women, Hunter insisted, frittered away their days doing unfathomable womeny things while their menfolk toiled to feed them. They also kept having children who were even more useless than their mothers. Hunter begged Portland not to send him any more of these irreclaimable wretches and urged that the colony be converted into the world's largest man-shed where a chap might spend many happy years without ever being nagged to put the bins out. Others, however, were preparing to move against MacArthur. The first blow was struck by Reverend Samuel Marsden, Reverend Johnson's new assistant. Marsden, who had been influenced by teetotal Methodists, was sent to minister in MacArthur's demands of Parramatta, where he preached against the corps' profiteering and distribution of spirits. With a ruddy face, piggy snout, melon-shaped head, and the strength of an ox on steroids, a legacy of his early years as a blacksmith, Marsden was the sort of preacher who believed in long early morning runs and cold showers. If you weren't into self-flagellation, he was prepared to do it for you, rapidly earning himself the nickname of the flogging parson. He saw sin everywhere, gloomily reporting that riot and dissipation, licentiousness and immorality pervaded every part of the colony. Marsden, though quick to find fault in others, found it easy to forgive himself. He had accepted a generous land grant and spent most of his time tending his four-legged flock while increasingly neglecting his spiritual one. And although he publicly railed against the evils of liquor, he paid his farmhands in rum. MacArthur, as Parramatta's magistrate, had rudely dismissed Marsden's demands to lay charges against Simon Byrne, a convict who had drunkenly abused Marsden on the Sabbath. Marsden had the last laugh when Byrne was stabbed to death 2 weeks later during one of his sermons. The Lord moves in mysterious ways. Marsden never forgave MacArthur for the Byrne affair, and the rivalry between these two headstrong men grew. Both had invested in the colony's first merinos, imported by Henry Waterhouse from the Cape of Good Hope in 1797, and the preacher was soon challenging Boddice Jack from both paddock and pulpit. Henry Waterhouse sold all of his merinos, deciding that his future did not lie in wool. Like some of his descendants, he was presumably more interested in fine cotton. Hunter, his admiration for MacArthur now waning, began to listen to Marsden, a brother misogynist, and resolved to return the magistracy to civilian control. Marsden replaced MacArthur on the bench. MacArthur took this badly and devoted his considerable energy to maligning Marsden and the other civilian magistrates. But he reserved his most vicious attacks for his former friend, Magistrate Richard Atkins, after Hunter proposed Atkins' appointment as Deputy Judge Advocate. Atkins was charming, handsome, and the best-bred settler in the colony, the son of a baronet and brother to an admiral and a general. He was also a gin-addled alcoholic, with a penchant for getting his kit off when drunk, and had fled to New South Wales to escape his circling creditors. When Atkins accused two soldiers of turnip theft, MacArthur requested information about this heinous crime in a letter addressed to Mr. Richard Atkins. Atkins, insulted that he had not been addressed as Richard Atkins Esquire, refused the request and sniffily concluded, "It is further, sir, necessary for me to inform you that any letters directed to Mr. Richard Atkins will be returned unopened." MacArthur dragged Governor Hunter into the dispute, who advised him that referring to Atkins as a mere mister was clearly intended to mortify him as a gentleman or to lessen him as a magistrate. MacArthur responded that he could not mortify Atkins as a gentleman, as he was not one, but "a man so deeply plunged in infamy, a man so vile, a public cheater, living in the most boundless dissipation, without any visible means of maintaining it. I will prove that in his public and official capacity, drunkenness and indecency are almost inseparable from him." He went on to accuse Atkins of issuing false notes, highway robbery, and indecent exposure while drunk. Atkins responded to these extraordinary, although probably accurate, charges with the most wonderfully vituperative letter in Australian history, accusing MacArthur of being a dastardly coward, the baseness of whose heart even imagination, however warm, can hardly portray. "Despicable littleness pervades your every action. Return to your original nothing. We know what you have been and what you now are, and believe me, an honest and industrious staymaker is a more honourable and more useful member of society than such a man as I hold you to be. Viper, you bite a file. The day of retribution will come, and believe me, it is not far off, when you shall be dragged forward by the strong arm of justice to public view as a monster of society, the assassin of all that constitutes true honour. You are a leper in reputation, and that you ought to be driven from the society and all good men, lest you should be infectious." Being a gentleman, Atkins signed this letter, "Your humble servant." MacArthur's charges against Atkins were heard by Marsden, who, recalling MacArthur's own lack of interest in prosecuting drunks, dismissed them. Atkins was appointed Deputy Judge Advocate and waited for the moment when he might strike MacArthur down. Hunter, who had now twigged that MacArthur was a wolf in Merino's clothing, begged Portland to recall the Corps to England, describing them as "a set of the worst, the most atrocious characters that ever disgraced human nature." 3 years after his arrival, he finally enforced the limit of 2 convicts per landowner, but he never found the courage to challenge the Corps' trading or grog running. While Hunter was dithering, MacArthur moved to isolate him. Pamphlets were circulated accusing Hunter's steward, Nicholas Franklin, of trading in rum. Franklin committed suicide. George Johnson had been appointed Hunter's aide-de-camp. Hunter's lifelong bachelor status and interest in the arts have led some historians to speculate that he needed no help being camp. MacArthur had developed a dirt file on his fellow officer, and Johnston was shipped back to Britain on charges of paying a soldier in spirits. The hapless Hunter increasingly withdrew into the bush, temporarily forgetting his troubles by searching for new animals to sketch. It was during one of these trips that Hunter discovered the platypus, which he promptly killed and posted to Sir Joseph Banks. Hunter couldn't take a trick. When the platypus was unpacked in Britain, Hunter's fellow naturalist denounced it as a hoax, concluding that a Chinese taxidermist had sewn bits of a duck and a beaver together in an attempt to make British scientists look silly. Meanwhile, MacArthur was writing obsequious letters to Portland, claiming that the governor had ignored his advice that landowners should feed and clothe their convicts and had refused his generous offer to pay for the upkeep of 100 of the lovable rascals. MacArthur was not just economical with the truth, he bankrupted it. But MacArthur's lies were the sort of lies that Portland wanted to hear. On 16 April 1800, Philip Gidley King returned to the colony to tell his old comrade that Portland had sacked him for being a useless tit and that he, King, was now in charge. Broken, Hunter returned to Britain and was given command of the HMS Venerable, which he promptly sank. MacArthur now had one governor's scalp hanging from his belt and had sworn to avenge himself on Marsden, Atkins and the other pygmies who opposed him. He had lived up to the motto of the kings of his ancestral Scotland, Nemo me impune lacessit, none shall provoke me with impunity. Interlude with the Bastard 2. William Bligh woke on the morning of 27 August 1791. The sun was shining, the seagulls were singing, and he had a lovely bunch of coconuts. If he were French, he would have thought himself suffering from déjà vu. If he were French, he would have thought himself suffering from déjà vu. Unpleasant feeling, isn't it? Bligh was again doing the Tahiti to Jamaica breadfruit run. Sir Joseph Banks was not the kind of man to admit failure, so he had ordered a second expedition. Neither was he the kind of man to admit he had chosen a complete tosser as expedition leader. So Bligh was again at the helm of a ship overloaded with both breadfruit and disgruntled sailors. But this time there was no Christian. Instead, Bligh had chosen his nephew, Francis Godolphin Bond, as his second in command. Bond's hero worship of Bligh soon made way for bitter resentment. He wrote to his brother, "Our relation has the credit of being a tyrant in his last expedition, where his misfortunes and good fortune have elevated him to a situation he is incapable of supporting with decent modesty. The very high opinion he has of himself makes him hold every one of our profession with contempt. He has treated me, nay, all on board, with insolence and arrogance." Bligh's men spent their long days at sea, lugging breadfruit trees up from the hold to enjoy the sunlight and carting them back below decks at night. Bligh reserved most of the expedition's fresh water for the plants, while the parched sailors were reduced to licking drops from their leaves. Bligh finally docked in Jamaica 6 years, 2 voyages and 1 mutiny after he had first set out to deliver breadfruit to the African slaves. The slaves took one look at the fruit, turned up their noses and refused to eat it. There's just no pleasing some people. Pemulwuy and the amazing Technicolor Dreaming Coat. Bennelong had done all the things Australian tourists usually do in England. Visited St Paul's Cathedral, attended the theatre, boated on the Thames and stopped in at a museum where he was shown the preserved heads of Indigenous people from all over the world. He also learned how to box, play badminton and drink spirits. But his travel buddy, Yamarawani, had succumbed to England's miserable climate and awful food, and now it was time for Bennelong to come home. He hitched a lift with Hunter, returning to country in 1795. Bennelong wrote the first known letter by an Aboriginal on 29 August 1796, telling Philip, "Not me go to England no more, I am at home," a refrain echoed by generations of Australian backpackers. Bennelong's homecoming was a difficult one. He saw himself as a gentleman of consequence, and when his sister, Karangarang, joyfully greeted him as he disembarked from the Reliance, he berated her for being naked. He told his people he wanted to teach them to love one another and would no longer tolerate them cutting each other's throats like savages. Bennelong fought a younger man, Karui, in an attempt to win back a lover and insisted on settling the dispute with his fists. Karui speared him in the back and got the girl. Bennelong drifted between two cultures and was at home in neither. The Eora accused him of black magic, and he wore out his welcome with Hunter when he speared a soldier who intervened in a payback dispute. He was beaten with muskets and dragged away, his one-time admirer David Collins branding him a most insolent and troublesome savage. Bennelong's sense of dislocation was shared by other Eora, who sought the comforts of bread, tea, sugar and spirits on the streets of Sydney. The colonists who had once looked on the Aborigines with patronising wonder began to see them through a darker, twisted lens. Sergeant John Harris wrote, "The whole tribe with their visitors have plagued us ever since, nor can we now get rid of them. They come and go at pleasure." Elizabeth MacArthur, who judged a people's worth by the standards of the debutante ball, reported that the natives are certainly not a very gallant set of people who take pleasure in escorting their ladies. If Bennelong was the broken heart of his people, then Pemulwuy was their fighting spirit. Pemulwuy, who had earlier disposed of John McIntyre, Philip's gun-happy gamekeeper, was a Darug man of striking appearance. A warrior and wise man rolled into one, Pemulwuy had a flecked eye and clubbed foot, and reputedly got about in a cloak stained with the pigment of each of the Sydney tribes. Pemulwuy's amazing technicolour dreaming coat led to him being known as the Rainbow Warrior. An Antipodean Che Guevara who smoked colonists instead of cigars, he waged a decade-long guerrilla war against the invaders, setting fire to their isolated farmsteads, their fields, and less successfully, their sheep. The Aborigines, who had successfully set fire to things for tens of millennia, were confounded by the non-flammable properties of wool. Pemulwuy's attacks killed over 30 colonists, a blood debt that would be repaid with interest. The war on the Cumberland Plain was a war of survival. The colonists had built their farms on the richest hunting grounds and waterways, so the people of the plain were left to choose between starving, begging, retreating into the territories of hostile neighbours, or fighting back. Pemulwuy went for option D. Pemulwuy's ability to appear from nowhere, set fire to a surprised colonist, and vanish into the smoke scared the bejesus out of the settlers. He was viewed with superstitious awe, and it was whispered that firearms could not kill him. Pemulwuy was regularly shot and, despite having more lead in him than an architect's pencil case, would relentlessly pursue his enemies as musket balls filled the air around him. In 1795, a giant African convict, Black Caesar, smashed in Pemulwuy's skull. The colonists celebrated the Rainbow Warrior's death and were surprised when he came back bigger and badasser than ever, leading 100 warriors in an attack on Parramatta. Pemulwuy was shot, again, and captured during the Battle of Parramatta. An incredible 8 ounces of lead was removed from his body, and because the soldiers admired his fighting skills, they did not execute him on the spot. Instead, they chained him to a hospital bed so that he could recover sufficiently to be decently hanged. But Pemulwuy rose Lazarus-like from his cot, snapped his bonds, and decamped at speed through the nearest window. While many Aboriginal people were drawn to life in Sydney, the cultural traffic was not all one way. The authorities were deeply disturbed by reports of Europeans in Pemulwuy's raiding parties and declared several men outlaw, including John Wilson, Bunbowee, for assisting the Aborigines in their attacks. The ineffectual Hunter never got to grips with the Pemulwuy problem, but Governor King was a beast of different stripe. He offered 20 gallons of rum and 2 suits of clothing to the man who bought him the Rainbow Warrior, dead or alive, and ordered that the natives be driven back from the settlers' habitations by firing on them. King's banishment of Aboriginal people from the settled areas was designed to turn the town Eora against Pemulwuy so they would inform on him. The Rainbow Warrior was finally sunk by Henry Hacking on 1 June 1802. The other Rainbow Warrior was tautologically sunk by French frogmen in Auckland on 10 July 1985. Hacking was a hopeless drunk, and the promise of a year's free booze provided a powerful motive for murder. He presented Pemulwuy's bullet-ridden body to Governor King, who removed the head, pickled it, and sent it to Sir Joseph Banks with a covering letter that read, "Although a terrible pest to the colony, Pemulwuy was a brave and independent character. Understanding that possession of a New Hollander's head is among the desiderata, I have put it in spirits and forwarded it by the Speedy." Banks started his impressive Aboriginal head collection in 1793. He gave the first head he received to the German skull nut, Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, the father of scientific racism. Banks, being a botanist, was used to people saying it with flowers rather than pickled heads, and was thrilled by the originality of King's gift. He replied that Pemulwuy's head was very acceptable to our anthropological collectors and makes a figure in the museum of the late Mr. Hunter. Dr. John Hunter, no relation to the governor, was another skull-loving buddy of Banks. He was an eminent surgeon and anatomist and brother to William Hunter, who, along with the unfortunately named William Smellie, was the father of modern obstetrics. The Hunter brothers and Smellie are now suspected of having arranged the murder of up to 40 pregnant women to provide them with corpses for experimental caesareans, a serial killing spree that makes Jack the Ripper look like a rank amateur. Today, Sydney Aboriginal elders demand the return of Pemulwuy's head, which, despite being 17,000 kilometres away from his legs, has gone walkabout. Prince William has now agreed to search for Pemulwuy's missing head, so it's bound to turn up soon. It is ironic that the Sydney suburb of Pemulwuy hosts the New South Wales Police Force's Forensic Laboratory, which has one of the largest collection of human heads in the Southern Hemisphere. Pemulwuy's passing concluded the Eora and Darug people's large-scale armed resistance. King lifted the banishment order, allowing Aboriginal people to return to the settled areas. He had made his point. Aboriginal bravery and independence would be rewarded with an extended stay on a dusty museum shelf. Interlude with the Bastard Three. Okay, the whole breadfruit thing had been a bit of a flop, but Bligh was not disheartened. As far as he was concerned, any voyage in which his crew did not set him adrift in the middle of the Pacific or make him walk the plank weighted down with coconuts was a success. In 1797, the crews of 16 Royal Navy ships mutinied at Spithead. The sailors had not had a pay rise in 139 years, despite inflation having driven up the price of rum, tattoos, prostitutes and other essentials. The mutiny was of great concern to King George, as he was at war with the new French Republic and the British fleet was all that stood between him and a date with Madame Guillotine. Lord Howe, Admiral of the Fleet, invited the rebel leaders to dinner with his wife and ordered them a royal pardon, a wage increase and improved meat rations. The mutineers accepted the deal. Lord Howe is otherwise best known for disproving the ridiculous claim of poet John Donne that no man is an island. Meanwhile, Bligh was in command of the HMS Director at the Nore, near the mouth of the Thames. Just as the Spithead Mutiny was drawing to a close, the crew of the Director and 25 other ships rose up against their captains. The deal struck with Howe was not enough. They also demanded that the King dissolve Parliament and make peace with France. The Nore fleet blockaded London, crippling British trade, and the mutiny's leaders urged their followers to defect to the French Republic. The revolution petered out when most of the sailors refused to sail for France. Bligh's crew were the last to surrender. Several dozen Nore mutineers were transported to New South Wales, which they considered a holiday in comparison to serving under Bligh. Alas, their fun in the sun would be cut short when the bounty bastard arrived in the colony wearing his shiny new governor's hat. The return of King. For the moment, however, the governor's hat still sat atop the balding head of Philip Gidley King. By 1800, Whigs were so last century. Unlike Hunter, King was a family man, so much so that he had two of them. The saintly Mrs. King cared for one of the governor's bastard sons by his former convict housekeeper, as well as for her own children. A passionate advocate for the rights of little bastards, King converted Sydney's most expensive house into a school for orphan girls, which he paid for by imposing a 5% duty on imported spirits. The Australian welfare system was born, and its fragile roots were watered with rum. Australian governments no longer rely on alcohol to fund social services, as alcohol is addictive and contributes to a range of social problems. They now rely on gambling revenue instead. King also provided a social safety net for convict women, who before 1805 were left to find their own accommodation. As women had limited employment opportunities, this often meant moving in with a man who wanted someone to keep his kitchen clean and his bedroom dirty. Governor King gave women another choice. They could seek refuge in the new female factory at Parramatta. Samuel Marsden was initially opposed to the factory, which he regarded as a grand source of moral corruption, insubordination and disease. However, he became an enthusiastic supporter when he realised that A, the factory had the largest collection of spinning wheels in the colony, and B, he had the largest collection of sheep. Marsden's attacks on the colony's concubines, as he referred to unmarried women, became less strident when they proved a useful source of cheap labour. King had no formal orders from Britain when he arrived in Sydney, so he simply made them up and blamed Portland for his anti-core reforms. He reduced spirit imports, established a public warehouse that undercut the core, gave convicts to landowners who agreed to feed them, encouraged civilian trading, and increased land grants to settlers and former convicts. MacArthur was so unsettled by this erosion of the core's profits that he offered to sell his colonial assets to the governor for £4,000 and return to England. King desperately wanted to rid the colony of the man he referred to as the devil's nephew, but displayed uncharacteristic indecisiveness in seeking Portland's permission for the deal. The Home Secretary was amazed that a serving officer could amass such a fortune and refused the request. He wrote separately to William Paterson, the commandant of the corps, directing that soldiers be forbidden from farming. Paterson made sure he lost the order. The relationship between governor and entrepreneur rapidly deteriorated. MacArthur encouraged his fellow officers to refuse King's dinner invitations, which was about as rude as you could get in 1801. When Paterson refused to snub the governor, MacArthur told King that Paterson was behind the dinner boycott. He showed King letters from Paterson that were critical of the governor and circulated private correspondence from Mrs. Paterson that showed her in an unfavourable light. Paterson challenged MacArthur to a duel. MacArthur loaded his own pistol in breach of duelling etiquette and blew his commanding officer away. He then crowed over Paterson's twitching body, which was considered poor form. King wanted to try MacArthur for creating dissension between himself and Paterson, but knew he would never secure a conviction before a jury comprising officers under MacArthur's thrall. So, as Paterson hovered between life and death, King sent MacArthur to London for court-martial, writing to the Home Office, "Many and many instances of his diabolical spirit has shown itself. He has been the master worker of the puppets he has set in motion. If Captain MacArthur returns here in any official character, it should be that of governor, as one half of the colony already belongs to him, and it will not be long before he gets the other half." MacArthur turned exile into a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. King had sent three copies of the charges against him to London. One with Captain McKellar, a corps officer who had accused MacArthur of poor sportsmanship in the duel, one with Lieutenant Grant, and one with MacArthur himself. MacArthur unsurprisingly claimed he had never received the charges against him. Grant's copy was mysteriously stolen from his strongbox, and McKellar's copy sank with McKellar somewhere in the Pacific. The case against MacArthur had not so much collapsed as evaporated into thin air. He was gently chided for shooting a fellow officer, and King was reprimanded for sending such a useful fellow back to England. The stresses of office, exacerbated by MacArthur's circulation of lies against him back in London, were beginning to get to King. Mrs. King had to hide the Government House drinks trolley, as her husband had embarked on increasingly frequent port binges, aggravating his gout and leaving him prone to intemperate outbursts. The increasingly paranoid governor replaced his corps bodyguard with convicts. Meanwhile, Napoleon had cut off Britain's wool supply. Although Sir Joseph Banks had been paying smugglers to run about the Spanish countryside abducting merinos for the king's flock, domestic supply was still insufficient to meet Britain's insatiable demand. Seeing an opportunity, MacArthur wasted no time in telling everyone that he was the only colonist who used sheep for anything other than immoral purposes. He, John MacArthur, sheep whisperer extraordinaire, would single-handedly save the British wool industry, if the government would only give him a measly 10,000 acres of the colony's finest grazing land and a few of Banks's prize merinos. It was a testament to MacArthur's charisma that ex-Governor Hunter was a strong advocate of this scheme. Banks, however, was having none of it. Having developed a visceral dislike for the oily officer, he announced that New South Wales was completely unsuitable for sheep farming and warned that exporting sheep was illegal. MacArthur, who by now had friends in high places, obtained an export exemption and defiantly bought 11 of Banks's merinos at auction. On the morning of 8 June 1805, Governor King was greeted by the sight of a smirking MacArthur parking his new ship, the Argo, complete with golden fleece figurehead, at the dock below Government House. MacArthur saw himself as the heroic Argonaut Jason, returning in triumph from exile with the mythic fleece that would cement his rule over his kingdom. MacArthur handed King a letter from Lord Camden, Secretary of the Colonies, instructing that MacArthur had immunity from prosecution for his past conduct, had resigned his military commission, was to be granted 5,000 acres of the colony's best land, and could choose 30 convicts to shear his sheep. King knew when he was beat. He shook MacArthur's hand and gave him the largest land grant in the colony's history. MacArthur named his new estate Camden in honour of his benefactor and planted an olive tree outside Elizabeth Farm as a gesture of peace. And because he liked olives. The peace would not last long. King was soon informed that he would be replaced because of the unfortunate differences which have so long subsisted between you and the military officers of the colony. He collapsed from nervous exhaustion and gout on the voyage home and died within months of his return. MacArthur 2, Governors nil. Interlude with the Bastard 4. The Bounty Bastard had distinguished himself during the 1801 Battle of Copenhagen and been promoted to command the HMS Monarch. Although Bligh was once more in the Admiralty's good books, his crews continued to loathe him. One of the Monarch's midshipmen wrote that Bligh's manners and disposition were not pleasant, and his appointment to the Monarch gave very general disgust to the officers. In 1805, Bligh was court-martialed for abusing one of his lieutenants and for tyrannical and oppressive and unofficer-like behaviour. The charges were found part proven, and Bligh was admonished to be in future more correct in his language. The verdict didn't worry Bligh, because as far as he was concerned, the officers who had found against him were a pack of f***ing useless Patrimonium. The colonists no longer viewed the Irish as genial village idiots who liked to drink. They were now seen as genial village idiots who liked to drink and murdering colonists in their beds. William Paterson's wife, Elizabeth, summed up the colony's fast-growing anti-Irish sentiment, recounting her fear of Irish private assassins breaking into our houses in the dead of night, in which they were all too successful in their own country. Britain had been deeply shaken by the American and French revolutions and the republics that emerged from their ashes. This all men are created equal and liberté, égalité, fraternité business was against everything the class-conscious British stood for. Terrified that the seeds of republicanism would take root in its green and pleasant land, Britain introduced harsh new treason and